crying of the hungry in the desert.
Hey guys, I have a fun surprise for you. In the next 2 weeks, we have two special, very bonus episodes for you coming out. Normally, we do the podcast every other week, but it's Christmas come early. We've got two extra Succession podcasts coming your way. And podcast favorite historian Christopher C. Smith has been absent for a while. Have you noticed? The lovely man done and went and got himself hitched. So on behalf of the Sunstone Mormon History Podcast and the Chris Smith fans everywhere, I want to offer him a hearty congratulations. He'll pop in again soon. I promise. But for now, he's given us a bonus episode today. Think of it as his wedding gift to us.
I wanted matching Tupperware, but I'll settle for a social network analysis into how Mormon schisms happen. Chris Smith has conducted a fascinating interview with scholar Joseph West about how and why Mormon schisms start and then how they develop.
This is a skill set that any lover of Mormon history had better get acquainted with, because if you haven't learned by now, Mormonism loves schismatic breaks more than it allows bathroom breaks in primary.
So Chris interviews therapist Joseph West, who's also a Mormon studies scholar and also co-founded the Mormon transhumanist movement. This interview is really important because it talks about how religions continue after their founder dies. Remember, we talk about very few survived the death of that first leader. There are certain patterns that happen when the founder of a religious movement dies that can ensure longevity in that movement. And Joseph West outlines those here. So if you're looking to take over your current proffer or founder, listen up, folks. He'll give you a roadmap.
And wait, can we just talk about transhumanists for just a minute? Because listen up, kids, if you don't know about the Mormon transhumanists, you need to. I got introduced to them through my work at Sunstone. I call them Star Trek Mormons, but let me kind of try to explain this. And Joseph West and Carl Youngblood and all you good Mormon transhumanists, Blair Osler, if I get this wrong, tell me. But it's worth knowing and it's worth looking into. And mostly because I've been on a huge AI and simulation theory kick the past few months. I've been reading a lot of Max Tegmark's work. He's a physicist and he's talking about simulation theory and the potential of AI. And I've been going down this rabbit hole of quantum computing and quantum physics. And the Mormon transhumanists are people that look to the future. They believe that Mormon doctrine is rooted in the science of future and AI. And whenever I hear that, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. That's Star Trek. That's cool. What an interesting theory. But the more that I learn about intelligent AI and AGI and these supercomputers and the way that machines and computers can work and the theories and what physics allow, the more I'm like, oh, those Mormon transhumanists, they're kind of smart. So if you want to check out what they're doing, it's something interesting that has nothing to do with the podcast we're talking about today. It was interesting to hear Joseph West do the scholar route because I know him as a Mormon transhumanist. So let's listen to him and Chris Smith give this great interview and talk about the dynamics of what causes movements to stick around long after the founder dies. I think it's worth noting into what we're talking about with a Mormon succession crisis. And then next week, we have a really fun surprise we've been plugging for a long time.
I've been around Mormon history for a while. I honestly don't think I have ever heard more buzz after a presentation at MHA than Katie's presentation last year. I remember that day because Chris, my coworker, was actually at the conference. I was back at the store and I was just kind of monitoring on Twitter, seeing what people were saying. And the second she started talking, I start seeing all these tweets about it. And then as soon as she was done, Twitter went crazy. I've never seen that much interest in a presentation for a long time.
We've been trying to get her on ever since. So this week we have this fascinating presentation with Joseph West, this interview with Chris Smith, and next week, stay tuned for Katie. Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
That only this is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners Brigham, from our roots young. Until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Young.
Hello again. This is Mormon historian Christopher Smith, and I'm here today with Joseph West, who has a master's degree in sociology from the University of Arizona. He's now out of the academic game. He co-owns and operates a private group psychotherapy practice with locations in Salt Lake City and Tucson. And he's also a co-founding member of the Mormon Transhumanist Association. Joseph, thanks so much for being with us today to talk about the Mormon succession crisis.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Yeah, so you co-authored a paper on the Mormon succession crisis with some, you know, sociology theory that you discussed, along with Eric Shoon, who I assume was a graduate school advisor. Is that right? Or
just no, a fellow graduate student, okay. And his name's Eric Schoone, but yes.
Schoone, okay. And the title of the paper is From Prophecy to Practice, Mutual Selection Cycles and the Routinization of Charismatic Authority, which is quite a mouthful. It's a bit of an intimidating title, which I think is why probably a lot of people don't know about the paper, but it's actually a really important paper. And I think that Mormon historians can't afford to miss this paper. So first of all, congratulations on a fine piece of scholarship here.
Yes, thank you.
So in your paper, I really appreciated this line about how in almost any new religion, the death of the founder is a really pivotal moment. It's a turning point in the religion's history. You say, through the selection of a new leader, the charismatic elements of the organization are disassociated from the original charismatic figure and are subsequently transferred to the administrative apparatus. So can you break that down for our listeners a little bit and speak to why the death of the founder is such an important moment in Mormon history and in the history of any religion?
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, with that line in particular, I think we're squarely within the theory of Max Weber's sociology of religion and his kind of like breakdown of kinds of authority, traditional being one, rational legal authority, which is kind of like institutionalized authority. And then the third kind, which is like the wild card, which is charismatic authority. Like Joseph Smith is like a prototypical example of that. And actually, it may be the case that Weber's theory is partly based on, he was learning about Joseph Smith at the time he was writing his theory. So traditional authority is like your parent or grandparent or like elders. Rational legal authority is like if you're conveyed a PhD, you're considered authoritative on something, you know, or like an office or, you know, and then charismatic is always disruptive of those other things because it provides authority from just kind of like the ether or like it's a little bit magical or hard to explain. That's why there's a lot of discussion and research about it is like you have a charismatic authority like Joseph Smith arise. He starts to set forward this institution. He starts to institute practices and doing things that are structuring or creating a new social structure. And then when that leader passes, you know, how does that transform the organization? And so basically that's what that line is talking about. That's kind of what the paper is about how that happened very particularly and specifically in the succession crisis.
So it's sort of like during Joseph's life, authority is vested in him by like the force of his personality and the power of his teachings, but that after he dies, they have to institutionalize that in the bureaucracy. Is that about right?
Yes, but also it's important to understand that it's already being institutionalized all the time during his life, you know, and like,
yeah,
but it's not just like pure charisma and then he dies and then it's pure institution. It's like there's a process, you know, and these moments, these breaking moments like the death are kind of like where you really need to examine to understand how that process happens and the social mechanisms that are deep down underneath there.
Yeah, it seems like Joseph Smith had a lot of different ways that he had institutionalized it during his life. And then at his death, they're sort of like trying to decide which of those to sort of settle on, which to crystallize and which to discard,
mm-hmm.
you know, as far as like who's going to be the successor to him. And it really seems to, they seem to settle on the Quorum of the 12, even though the Quorum of the 12, I think you suggest in your paper, was not necessarily the most obvious candidate from a theological standpoint.
Yes, correct. Or at least that was the argument that Brigham made that succeeded, you know? And so like empirically, that's the outcome, you know, either way. So
one of the things that I think is really cool about Mormonism is that even though Brigham Young was the clear winner in the succession crisis, a lot of the other contenders go on and start their own churches. And so we can kind of get a glimpse of the possible alternative futures in which someone other than Brigham Young had triumphed. And they all look pretty different from the path that the church took in Utah. And I think it really underscores how important that moment was.
Yeah, it does. And I also think it illustrates, that polygamy was and kind of still is in a way, at least historically, structurally, essential to Mormonism that's actually going to grow from a new religious movement to an institutionalized world religion, you know? So I think that's kind of an implication here also.
Cool. Well, let's get into the issue of how Brigham Young came to prevail in that succession crisis, because I think that's where you have some really unique insights in this paper. You argue that Brigham Young was in a really special position, which we'll get to in a minute, but that he came very close to losing out to William Marks for the simple reason that William Marks was in Nauvoo when Joseph died, while Brigham was away on a mission. So tell us a little bit about the delaying action that Willard Richards fought to give Brigham time to get home from the mission field.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the people pushing to appoint him at the time, it was for financial reasons as well. And so he wasn't going to actually be appointed as successor to Joseph, but he was going to be appointed as kind of like in charge of the finances of the church, and it would have strengthened his position going forward. But yes, to prevent that from happening, Willard Richards was a really important actor. And that's kind of revealed by a lot of the meeting notes. And there were several quorums, you know, there was the Quorum of Anointed, and there was the Quorum of 12 Apostles, there was the Council of 50, there was the Presiding High Council, and the First Council of 70. So there was five groups that were meeting regularly. But like, because of the absences, the only group that really had a coherence was the Quorum of Anointed. And so that became the social space where these arguments were taking place. And Willard Richards held an important position there and was kind of able to, on one instance, pretty much like dominate a meeting and kind of like call it to conclusion. And these delays was an important part of enabling Brigham Young to come back to Nauvoo to consolidate power, which he didn't quite have. For example, William Clayton was supportive of Marx at first. You know, if Marx could have had his momentum, he could have maintained William Clayton's support, another important figure. But then over the course of this delay, William Clayton was convinced by Newell K. Whitney that if Marx took over, polygamy would be done. And actually, Clayton had a plural wife. And so anyway, yes, what Willard Richards did was essential to what happened in terms of thinking of it in terms of social mechanisms. You know, Willard Richards' delay of an appointment of someone else was the first key step.
So in your paper, you perform what's called a social network analysis, and you conclude that Brigham Young's social network, and particularly the family ties that he had forged through plural marriage, gave him leverage that the other candidates didn't have. So tell us quickly about the data set that you used for that analysis and how you went about mapping those social networks.
Okay, yes. No, well, so an important point of clarification to start with is that the social network analysis that ended up in the paper is the network based on family ties, okay, which so that meant that the practice of plural marriage strongly influenced that network. But we also looked at other networks, and actually we began with, it didn't end up in the paper, but we began with a network just looking at those five quorums that I just mentioned: the First Presidency, the Quorum of 12, Anointed Quorum, Presiding High Council, First Council of 70, and Council of 50. We took all of the members of those, and that ended up being, I think, 74, maybe 76, including Joseph and Hiram. And then that was kind of what our network began with. And we first did a bunch of analysis on we call this an affiliation network because it's groups and persons. And within that network, it was interesting that Brigham Young does not have, in terms of the mathematical measures, he does not have a structural advantage compared to Sidney Rigdon and William Marks. He was about equally as empowered. And so that's kind of a puzzle, because you would think that the institutions and these quorums and like really official structures that Joseph Smith is setting up would determine the outcome. And I think that actually, as time goes on, that would be more and more the case. But one of the interesting findings was that it wasn't this specific patriarchal or like authority structure that was determinative in terms of like who's empowered within that network. It was instead the network of close family ties. Okay. And when I say close family ties, I mean first cousin or closer, and also in-laws, you know, so sister-in-law, et cetera, father-in-law. And if you look at and then the Joseph Smith network is pretty tightly bound around him. Okay. And so then you have the moment of his death, and then you look at the network right after, and it really blows the network up. It's kind of into a few different parts. And so that's kind of where we're looking at, okay, now in this blown up network, where are we looking at who has advantage in terms of these theories in social network theory about structural advantage within social structure, social networks. And we find that those are the networks where Brigham Young was the most empowered. And then kind of the point of the paper is to turn that structural analysis back onto the historical data and kind of like put those two things in dialogue, that it actually was his position in the network of close family ties that enabled him to access resources in terms of like convincing other people, you know, getting support around him, consolidating support around him.
And so as I understand it, what you're looking for in a social network analysis like this is the breadth of the network is really what gives you power, breadth and diversity of the network, not the depth. So it doesn't necessarily help me if I have like a really dense network of very close friends who are all close friends with each other as well. You want like a much broader net. I want to have friends in multiple cliques. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I mean, our analysis is based on the idea of structural holes, which is kind of a theoretical idea in social network analysis. You can think of power within a network in several ways. You could think of it first and most primitively as like number of ties, you know? The idea of structural holes is that it's like there's these closely knit networks. Like you can think of a group of an office, you know, a number of people that work together, or like a group of close friends, and those kind of exist in pockets. And if you're able to fill to like be a tie in both of those networks, that gives you advantage, relative advantage to other people in both networks, because you have other access to resources. And so this is what, because Brigham Young was, you know, not the most, but like he was very gung-ho about following Joseph into polygamy, in the practice of polygamy, he was the most empowered within this emerging family network, family structure network. He was the most empowered with the most ties. And that was because it was a lot because of his blood ties, like his first cousin, Willard Richards, his brother, Joseph Young, a couple of others. But there was other ties that were created through his obedience to the pronouncements of the charismatic authority.
Yeah. And so because he's got ties to multiple different cliques and multiple different quorums in Nauvoo, I think you suggest basically that he becomes the broker between them.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yes. Uh-huh. That's right. I'm the
So when you map the social network in Nauvoo, how is Brigham Young positioned in that map compared to other candidates like William and Samuel Smith? Sort of how do they rate in that analysis?
Well, according to the measures that we were using, which like I said, was this Ronald Burt structural holes measures, which kind of takes your total number of ties and then it sort of subtracts out something for the redundancy that you have. Brigham Young was just a little bit more empowered within this family of the close family tie network than the other candidates. But that's all it took. You know, it's a time of chaos and crisis. And so he just needed that little bit of structural advantage. And what we argue is that the structural advantage within the close family tie network is important because that's what Joseph Smith was talking about. That's what the charismatic authority was trying to change the social structure through these marriage practices. And so it's no coincidence that the ones who were most embracing that ended up being advantaged within that emerging network. So
yeah, it's interesting that historians like Richard Bushman talk about polygamy as building a dynasty, you know, and then it really does put Brigham Young in this like powerful position. And so there's some reality to the idea that you are, you know, a dynastic leader if you're active in plural marriage.
Oh yeah. And even if you look at to that point, the social networks that are presented in the paper, one, it's like right after Joseph dies. If you were to fast forward like 3-4 years, it's that social network is so powerfully consolidated around Brigham Young through marriage. And so whether or not Brigham was intending to be strategic about his marriages, I mean, the result was, you know, as a result of the way that he networked within this new structure of plural marriage, he made himself just sort of like so central and powerful. And so, so, one of the things that I think is interesting about the paper is that the conclusion we come to about why Brigham Young, you know, emerged as the leader after the succession crisis, that conclusion from this perspective of social science is not inconsistent with pretty much kind of like the party line story of the reason why Brigham Young rose, which was because he, you know, which is like his obedience to Joseph Smith. And he was the only one who could have carried what Joseph Smith was doing. And I think that our analysis kind of like illustrates that in detail and in terms of the emerging social structure about how that's actually, you know, kind of not an accurate way to characterize it.
Yeah. And even the way that Joseph Smith frames it theologically in terms of like building a kingdom, that in some ways is an accurate reflection of the social science reality that you're describing as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think the methods of social network analysis, I mean, it's interesting if you have been trained in social network analysis, kind of like a thinking about things in a certain way, then you read Joseph Smith, you begin to see how much his imagination and prophetic vision was, you know, in terms of social networks and creating social networks and tying people together. And so that's also kind of a thing about the paper. I think the methodology is consistent with exactly what he was attempting to do theologically. So,
yeah, he was really insightful about how social networks work and how power works, I think.
I hear them all, I hear them all, I hear them all. I hear the sounds of tearing pages and the roar of burning paper. All the crimes and acquisition turn to air and ashes.
So there's another social science perspective, and I'm thinking particularly of the work of Michael Hogg at Claremont, which suggests that the power within a group accrues to the most prototypical member of that group. And in your paper, you note that Brigham Young was very much helped by the fact that he embraced polygamy, and William Marx was hurt by the fact that he rejected polygamy. And since most of the top Mormon leadership at this point was actively practicing polygamy and deeply invested in it, they wanted a leader who embraced polygamy. And Brigham Young was one of the most active practitioners of polygamy. So arguably, he was very prototypical at the time of this sort of inner circle of decision makers in Nauvoo. How can we tease apart how much of Brigham's success was attributable to his position in this social network, and how much might be attributable to his prototypicality on this polygamy issue?
Yeah, okay. Well, I think that's a really good question. And I guess my response is that he becomes the prototypical member of the group because of his place in this emerging social network of close family ties. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So the two things are maybe not separable.
Hard to tease out. Those might be the same thing
yeah.
in some ways.
Right. You might even suggest that in this prototypicality theory, the advantage that's conferred by prototypicality is that prototypicality helps you build a social network within the group, right? Something like that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's not like anyone at the time knew that, you know, Brigham Young's measure on these Ronald Burt measures was a certain number. You know what I mean? They're just acting. They're just social actors in a really confusing moment. And it's like, that position in the network that is empowering him is not seen at all.
Yeah, it's invisible to the people involved.
Right. And so I'm saying, I guess, that social structure, the power that comes from the social structure is misrecognized, and it's hidden within the prototypical member.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. So I'm curious, what would happen if you included Emma Smith in an analysis like this, because of course she was a pretty connected and influential person, as we can see from how close she came from to getting William Marx elected, because she was the one really pushing for William Marx.
Correct. Yes. No, I mean, that's an important point. I mean, you had a couple of things there, but I do think it's important to kind of like point out that structurally, like we, even within this analysis, the women that were influential are made invisible. And so like there actually are women that are present in these networks presented, but they're only represented the network as through the ties between the men. You know what I mean? And so that is an important weakness of the structural analysis, is that we bounded the network by membership in these top quorums, you know? And so that excluded any women and especially Emma. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that that's, I don't know, whatever, a place for future research. I don't know if I myself will do it. Maybe, you know, in a distant future, I would like to have ambitions for some kind of project like that. But, or what I would like to see is a much bigger network analysis that includes much more people than these top 74, you know, priesthood holders, basically.
Yeah, I would love to see that too. And I hope that somebody does it at some point. Maybe we can interest Eric, your co-author, in doing it. Well, thank you again for interviewing with me. Just really interesting paper, and I would highly encourage people to go look at it. Great stuff.
Well, thank you.
I hear the crying of the hungry in the deserts where they're wandering. Hear them crying out for heaven's own benevolence upon them. Hear destructive power prevailing. I hear fools falsely hailing to the crooked wits of tyrants when they call.
Hi, I'm Stephen Carter, the host of the Sunstone Podcast. As I've looked through the names of people who have donated so generously to Sunstone during the past years, I've noticed something unique about them. They tend to use Mormonism as a gin spike, which I know sounds like an alcoholic drink, but it's actually more interesting than that. See, one day, probably 20 years ago, I was out in rural Wyoming helping my father-in-law, Ross, do some surveying. Being the strong hunk of man I am, I was assigned to hold the reflector while Ross handled the theodolite. We were surveying near a county road, and at one point, we had to put down a marker in the middle of that road. So Ross takes out a 5-inch metal spike and pounds it into the asphalt with a hammer. Pretty tough spike, I said. They tend to be, Ross told me. They have to live 2 lives. He pulled another spike out of his truck and he handed it to me. I looked at it closely and I saw that it wasn't just a spike. Its head tapered toward the middle, like a flat top pyramid. And it looked like a gear. The spike itself had a kind of sawtooth on both sides. It's called a gin spike, Ross said. They start out as part of a cotton picker, but eventually they wear out. But surveyors found a use for them. You can pound them into asphalt, and those teeth on the side will keep it in. The tapered head makes sure that nothing like a snow plow gets hung up on it. And the fact that it's magnetic makes it really easy to find. It's the perfect semi-permanent surveying marker. Most people at Sunstone have gone through a faith crisis where either Mormonism doesn't seem to fit them anymore, or they don't seem to fit Mormonism. It's like the gin spike that wears out. But a lot of Sunstoners have found creative ways to make use of that gin spike, even if it was on the junk pile for a while. They claim Mormonism in their own way, doing something unique and useful with it. I'm grateful that I've been able to interact with these people so much during the past years. They were there when I needed someone to help me work through my own faith crisis. I love to meet back up with them at Sunstone conferences. I love to read their words in the magazine and online. And each year, they're also the ones who donate to Sunstone. See, Sunstone only covers its event and publication costs with registration fees and subscriptions. Everything else, the rent, the electricity, insurance, salaries, internet hosting fees, and on, are funded exclusively by donations. It's a testament to the goodness of this community that we've had enough funding for more than 4 decades to reach out to Mormons at their most difficult times. Thanks for being such an essential part of that work. As we head into the next year, we'd love to hear from you. We're interested in your thoughts on how we can better serve this generation of seekers. And your donation will go a long way toward helping that vision come to fruition. Get things rolling at sunstone.org/donate.
Won't you send destroying Danites, Brother Young? Spill my blood upon the earth, oh Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh Brother Young. And let it smoke ascend to heaven, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, Brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.